Do you want to pay cash or?
No, definitely not.
If it's 24 months, it would run you $57 a month.
Selling an automobile is secondary. What we're actually selling is his ability to buy one.
We've gone very rapidly in the direction of facilitating borrowing, just advertising borrowing. In fact, I've sensed that merchants nowadays make more money off credit than they do off selling goods.
I really didn't know how much money I owed because the interest has climbed up so bad on me. That interest was just eating me up something terrible.
The competitive market to operate requires knowledge on the part of the buyer. And the buyer thinks he's got knowledge. He pays 6%. Everybody pays 6%. Everybody knows that everybody, when they borrow money, pays 6%. And the answer to that is nobody ever pays 6%. They pay much more.
Very few people know how much more, and frankly, very few people seem to care. Buy now is the national slogan. Pay later, the national habit. Eat your cake and have it too. For through the looking glass, debt is called credit. In this acquisitive society, a society of conspicuous consumption and conspicuous waste, the most conspicuous figure is what we owe. I owe you... $315 billion. Here now is CBS News correspondent Alexander Kendrick.
Take the cash and let the credit go, sang Omar Khayyam. That was far away and long ago, but the idea prevailed for centuries. Even within the present generation, status used to be conferred by solvency, that is, cash. Now it is conferred by credit, that is, debt, from which any previous stigma has been removed. The credit card has taken the place of the greenback and the silver cartwheel. Some people still save for a rainy day. More and more others get an umbrella on credit. Credit is the trade wind that keeps the American economy under full sail. Buying a new boat or car or home is not based on a man's present worth, but on his prospects. They are paid for out of next year's earnings. In fact, new debt is being taken on faster than old debt is being paid off. The American desire to own things has exceeded all prediction, some say all reason. Possessions are 9 points of the social law. And they score all the points in a new TV game in which the winner is the person who can snatch up the most from supermarket shelves.
And our number one challenger heading back toward the rear of the store.
The game is presumably not intended as social commentary. It has hardly raised an American eyebrow, either among viewers or among critics. And why should it? The climate encourages it as Americans wallow in the sixth unbroken year of prosperity. Every day brings new records of production and consumption. The American economy, like the universe, is ever expanding. It is no longer an achievement to sell iceboxes to Eskimos or anything else to anyone else. And more of the sales are on credit, including 90% of our homes, 60% of our cars, 50% of department store purchases. But this brings encouraging smiles instead of worried frowns from economists, bankers, and merchants. Dr. Charles Walker, economist and executive vice president of the American Bankers Association.
I would emphasize very strongly that the benefits of this sort of mechanism should not be overlooked and should be emphasized. With amortized credit, being able to pay for a house, for example, over a period of 2 decades to 3 decades, paying for automobiles so much per month. This means that many young people who otherwise would have to wait until middle age through saving before they could afford some of these things that make life easier and more pleasant, now can have them at an earlier stage of life. Instead of saving and buying the product later, you can go into debt now and then you save over this period of time that you enjoy it. I think that, if not gone into to excess, that that's all to the good. It's good for the borrower and it's good for the country.
Poor Richard's Almanac is out of print. Instead of being warned against debt, as we have been from Aristotle and St. Paul to Franklin and Emerson, we are warned that trouble begins only when debt is liquidated rather than increased. Does living off the fat of the land threaten us with economic cholesterol?
It is admitted that there are things wrong in our consumer economy. But as long as the economy is strong and expanding, as long as government advisors say that major recessions can be done away with and economic cycles ended by government manipulation, any doubts about credit are drowned out by the ringing of cash registers, or perhaps they should be called credit registers, and the pied piping of moneylenders.
Dear lady, here's wonderful news. Now you can own a brand new 100% human hair wig for just $2.50 a week.
Experience, trust, service. All reasons why you borrow confidently at Household Finance. At Household Finance, you can borrow up to $800, take up to 24 months to repay.
No down payment, only $1.25 a week.
How do you buy the new things you need while you still have old bills to pay? Easy. See the associates.
Now, don't let credit problems hold you back. No down payment required. Credit? You've got it at Motor City.
It's bill cleanup time at Beneficial Finance. Got any leftover bills? Get rid of them with cash from Beneficial. Beneficial is ready with the cash to do it.
Yet beneath the easy money anvil chorus, some questions and answers can be faintly heard. They are not concerned with morality or even very much with traditional economics. But at least they inquire about the operations of the credit business. Do borrowers and buyers on credit know what it is costing them? Do poor people, those who need credit the most, pay more for it than the rest of us? Does the inducement of easy credit cause many people to borrow more than they can comfortably afford to pay back? Are many people paying higher interest rates than they have to? If, as individuals, on our homes, our cars, our furniture, doctor's bills, travel, and education, were averaged out across the nation, every man, woman, and child would be in debt to the tune of $1,600. Do we know what we pay for debt? Senator Paul Douglas.
The borrower, consumer credit, seldom knows how much he's actually paying for the credit which he is getting. And he doesn't know the totals generally, and almost invariably does not know the true annual rate on the amounts actually owed which he is paying.
The finance industry disputes this. John Reynolds of New York's First National City Bank.
We interview thousands of people each day. Many of these people shop, and they shop to find out how many dollars more is it costing me in one institution as compared to another. That is, a bank as compared to a sales finance company and or a small loan company or a department store sometimes. And they know.
Who is right? The man with the answer has been studying consumer habits for 20 years, Dr. George Katona of the University of Michigan.
The one figure almost everybody knows is how much they must pay back every month. This is what they are really concerned with. This is the amount which they relate to their income. This represents a prior charge on the income. The second question, to which we get fairly good answers, but not really exact answers, is how many months they have to repay that. This is the best way then to construct an approximate figure of the total debt, which many people don't know. More importantly, they don't know the real costs of debt. They underestimate the expense of debt, and many are not even concerned with it too much.
The cost of credit is reckoned in many ways, some beguiling, some merely confusing, and sometimes it's not even mentioned at all. And it is difficult for the consumer to compare bank terms with store terms with finance company terms. But there is a way to do it, to translate all the various weekly, monthly, and yearly charges into something called true annual interest, or the real interest rate for 1 year. When a department store says the charge is 1.5% a month on the balance, the true annual interest rate is 18%. When a small loan company says the cost is 2%, 2.5%, or 3% a month, the true annual interest rate is 24, 30, or 36%. When a bank giving a car loan, a boat loan, a home improvement loan, or any other personal loan says the cost is $4.50 per hundred per year deducted in advance, the true annual interest rate is about 9%.
When you buy a television set for $125 and pay back $3 a week for a year, a common transaction in poor neighborhoods, the true annual interest rate is about 50%. A credit union's charge of 1% a month on the balance is a true annual interest rate of 12%. A $3,000 car financed through a dealer and paid for at $100 a month for 36 months carries an interest cost of $600 and a true annual interest rate of 13%. Used car rates are generally higher. For a home mortgage with a quoted interest rate of 6% a year, the true annual interest is, surprise, 6%. Senator Douglas has been trying for 5 years to get congressional passage of what he calls the Truth in Lending Bill.
It would inform the buyer and the borrower what the credit charges were, so that the buyer and borrower could take these into consideration and shop around for the best terms. They should be told the truth both as to the total cost of this credit in dollars, and this is even more important, told the cost in terms of the true annual rate on the amounts which they actually owe. In other words, to try to establish the principles of the so-called free market, where the buyers are presumed to know what the goods are that they buy.
Senator Douglas is opposed by almost all financial institutions and retailers. Dr. Ernst Dauer of Household Finance Corporation and John Reynolds of First National City Bank state the opposition argument.
It is difficult to comply with the law by reason of the fact that the transactions are not as simple as the law anticipates they would be. For example, if you were to come in and borrow $1,000 and tell me that you were going to repay it over a period of 12 months and that you wanted to make your payment on the 15th of each month and that the rate was $6 per $100 face amount of loan, I could very easily compute what the simple interest equivalent would be. However, suppose the first month you were late 5 days. I can't anticipate that in advance. The second month, you're early 3 days. The third month, you're late 11 days. You can see how impossible it would be for me to tell you at that very first instance when you were signing the note what the simple interest equivalent would be. Now, that's a simple type of credit. Now, the revolving charge type of credit that is used by department stores is even more complex. And in order to find out whether or not this could be done, whether compliance could be made by installment lenders, they went to the University of Michigan and they asked one of their mathematics professors, would he try to calculate simple interest on various transactions? And they gave him examples. And he could come up with different answers in almost each case.
The lenders already know what the rates are. And as a matter of fact, they have rate books indicating the rates on various amounts of debt, number of months, amount of monthly payments, and so forth. This information is furnished to them. They don't furnish the invitation to the borrower or the buyer.
I think there's no doubt about the fact that most people, all with the exception of a very, very minute percentage, do know what they are paying when they are using credit. Certainly in our case, it's easy enough to multiply 20 payments by a certain monthly amount and determine what the total repayments will be. Deduct from that the amount of cash they've received, and the difference is the charge.
They're afraid that if the true rates are known, that people will either not borrow or will not buy. My reply to that is that that's a very grave charge if true. It'd be a terrible charge to say that the sale of goods or the sale of credit depends upon keeping the buyer or borrower ignorant.
What is this thing called credit that we use so much but don't seem to know very much about? From whom did we borrow this $315 billion? What's it doing for us and to us? We'll have a look after this message.
Here again is CBS News correspondent Alexander Kendrick.
By the end of this month, we will owe $214 billion on the homes we live in and $69 billion more in installment loans on the things we put into those homes and the cars we park outside them.
We owe $17 billion to department stores, doctors, oil companies, banks, and credit card companies. Stockbrokers and insurance companies have lent us another $15 billion. The grand total, $315 billion. And the well-advertised man who used to carry only $50 in cash is now able to get by with 50 cents. We have almost arrived at the cashless society envisioned by the American writer Edward Bellamy. Or perhaps we have arrived. The Automatic Canteen Company of Chicago is test marketing a credit card vending machine. Coffee breaks on the tab, deducted from your paycheck at the end of the month. Whatever happened to the theory that money makes the mayor go? Or, more pertinently, what would happen if every exchange of goods or services required cash on the line? The president of Rich's department store in Atlanta, Harold Brockie.
It would be a catastrophe, not only to business, but to the total nation. If we stopped using credit, sales would drop, manufacturing would drop, payrolls would have to be cut immediately. In time, cut to nothing, because if we did not have credit, not only could we not maintain our businesses, but we would not have any area to sell our products.
Like charity, credit begins at home. Two-thirds of all American families own their own homes, or are under the impression they do. For an American home is not home without a mortgage. The building industry is by far the biggest user of credit in the nation, and mortgage debt is the largest single component of private debt. The monthly mortgage payments we make are usually regarded as a form of savings. But actually, the amount being withdrawn nationally through refinancing, that is, starting the debt all over again, now almost equals the total mortgage payoff. On a national average, only 50% of monthly mortgage payments reduce the principal. 50% are for interest. And mortgage terms are getting longer, especially on new homes. Over 30 years at 6%, a homeowner will pay back $32,400 on a $15,000 mortgage. Almost as rare as a home without a mortgage these days is a home without a car. The auto industry is in many ways the symbol of our 20th century. And besides design, material, and accessories, $29 billion worth of credit is tied up in our cars. Dealers often make as much on the credit as they do on the car through high interest rates and insurance commissions. His sign says no down payment, but this is how a New York used car dealer interprets it.
There's no such thing as no down payment. Even though we advertise no cash needed, what is meant by that, we don't actually need any of his own immediate cash if he qualifies. But there is a definite amount of money that is needed towards a down payment. Normally, it's about one-third of the usual selling price of an automobile. And if he does qualify and he doesn't have any of his own money, then we sometimes can arrange to, through various finance institutions that we use, to more or less loan him, arrange to loan him his necessary down payment.
Over the next 5 years, as an annual rate of 10 million cars is reached, a 50% increase in auto installment credit is anticipated. The question has been raised whether such a big bulge can be supported. But the auto industry feels that the alternative would be large cutbacks, not only in car manufacturing, but in all the industries which supply it, and large-scale unemployment. And then what would happen to the streets that Jack built? From New York's Fifth Avenue, the most glittering shopping thoroughfare in the world, down to all the main streets that have become Easy Street because you can charge it. What would happen on Forsyth Street in Atlanta, where in the largest retail store in the South, the sales were $125 million last year, two-thirds of them on credit? This is one of the ways it works, the revolving credit account.
Now, Mr. Hall, what we're going to do is add this to the same account that you purchased the other furniture on last spring. That's the one that we established you the $1,500 limit. Now, you've paid that down so that when we add this to it, it will not increase the terms of your contract. You'll keep on paying the same payment that you're paying now.
The credit manager of Rich's store is George Griffith. We asked him what rules were used in granting credit.
A man's always paid his bills and paid his debts promptly. and also has a good income, those are the two principal things that a credit man's interested in. Every credit transaction comes down to one simple moment of truth. You either say yes or no. You have to put up or shut up. Now, if you want to discuss a subject like this from an academic standpoint, you don't have to be right. You can be wrong, and you can have other people of equal eminence and stature say you're wrong, and nobody has to judge. But a credit man does have to judge, and he has to know. And unless he can keep most of his shots in the fairway, he's going to get in trouble.
How do you think Benjamin Franklin would feel about the business situation if he came back?
With the thinking he had in his time, he'd be as obsolete as a Model D Ford. But I think if Ben Franklin grew up today, as we have done, in this economy, I think he'd be one of the forerunners and leaders. He would understand this economy, and he would realize you can have your cake and eat it too.
In addition to home mortgages, auto financing, and retail credit, there are small loans made at big interest rates. Last year, small loan companies issued nearly $9 billion worth of installment credit at rates from 24 to 42%, although industry spokesmen point out that it costs them just as much to make a $100 loan as it does for a bank to lend $1,000. Why will a borrower go to a small loan company when money is available elsewhere for much less? Dr. Dower of Household Finance Corporation.
A large proportion of our people have some sort of financial problem. They have had an interruption of income. They have debts have piled up. They have perhaps bought unwisely. They have a financial problem. The bank cannot afford to take the time to work with them. The bank isn't interested in making loans to people with financial problems.
And then there is the credit card, the most prestigious identity card known. It identifies the bearer with all the good things that are going. Four big national credit card concerns, Diners Club, Carte Blanche, American Express, used mostly for travel, food, and entertainment, and Unicard for retail purchases, have done so much business that now more than 100 banks also issue credit cards, and so do scores of chain and individual enterprises. It is not true that in America the streets are paved with credit cards, but they can take people through whole weeks of living on the cuff once the problem of just carrying them is surmounted.
Seems like everywhere you go they give you one of these. Either put it on your table or press it into your hand or slip it into your pocket. I don't know. I suppose it's really a compliment. You look as if you can afford credit. Gives you a good feeling, though.
Mm-hmm.
Until the first of the month.
Yeah, this is the one.
Just like an accordion.
Yes, it is. What are you going to put that on, sir?
I'll put it on the American Express, yeah.
I got to find it first.
Most restaurant men say they couldn't stay in business without credit cards. Their big impetus comes from the income tax ruling, calling for receipts for entertainment expenditures. Those who pay cash in restaurants help pay the overhead for those who dine on credit. Even though there's no apparent charge for using a credit card, the restaurant or store must pay costs ranging up to 7% of the bill, and this cost is passed on to the cash and credit users alike. The credit card vogue began with businessmen and executives, but has been extended to all walks of life. It has also been extended to all kinds of uses.
Suppose I came in here just for the shine. Would that be all right on a credit card?
Well, it'll be a first.
But anything else, like a shampoo and a massage?
Manicure, hair coloring, or hair straightening, anything else you want, you can put on there.
Sun lamp?
Sun lamp treatment.
Tip, put the tip on?
Tip, manicure.
Do you get a bigger tip when they put it down on credit than you do when they pay cash?
Well, it seems to happen that way. People seem to be more liberal there.
Well, that's the trouble. I get one of these things and I go out and get the works, whereas if I didn't have it, perhaps I would just get a haircut, you know.
That's what prompted me to put them in.
Inevitably, the day will come when there will be a credit card for everything, although there are still a few things that present a problem.
Is it possible for me to ride on a credit card with you?
No good. Where are you going to collect the dough? Suppose the man lives in Minneapolis. I got to go to Minneapolis to collect my money. credit?
No, they send it to you. You can use a credit card around the world.
No, no, I don't believe in no credit card.
Cash.
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 You won't take a check either.
No, no check.
Well, if you can't lick them, join them.
You call
hire a limousine
card.
On credit.
Well, thank you.
A credit card was recently buried in the time capsule of the New York World's Fair, among other living symbols of our society. That society and the economy which provides its material foundation are shaped by the extension of credit and the financing of consumer purchases. But the direct point of impact is the borrowing and lending of money. The impetus for the cashless society, or its present reasonable facsimile, has to a large extent been brought about by changes in the nation's commercial banks. In the past 10 years, the banks have switched from their traditional corporation nursing to the care and nourishment of individual consumers. And in this vast proliferation in the forms and uses of credit, the First National City Bank of New York has led the rest. Its most recent move was to acquire the carte blanche credit card business. Citibank, third largest in the country and growing, has 600,000 personal loans outstanding amounting to $550 million. And while its old-fashioned banking business requires mechanization, the computing machines it has put in are more and more being used to keep track of consumer loans and to issue bills for doctors, dentists, and landlords, another form of credit. Since the war, Citibank has developed 21 separate types of consumer installment loans, covering almost every necessity, luxury, activity, or daydream that the average American family can conceive of. Ready Credit, pioneered by Citibank, is the banker's version of the revolving charge account. Dial a Loan is another Citibank innovation. Citibank devotes most of its $6 million advertising budget to wooing the consumer and in promoting ways to keep the credit pot boiling.
What about Dial a Loan, John? Do you think we ought to continue to push that?
No question about it. It's one of the services that we know responds to advertising almost directly. As soon as you run an ad, we do increase in the number of calls and the number of loans we can make, so we're very enthusiastic for it.
What else do you think we ought to be thinking about in our forward planning?
Well, the property modernization loan, I think we have to start maybe a little bit earlier this year than we did last year. I think we just lost maybe
2 weeks. At the spring market.
Yes, two weeks last year.
Citibank ads are noted for their pulling power based on a frank appeal to wish fulfillment.
First National City, the only bank your family ever needs.
We asked Thomas Wilcox, Executive Vice President of First National City Bank, whether the ads weren't putting into people's minds visions of sugar plums and other things that they didn't even know they wanted until they were told they did.
We mean something more than yen. We mean honest interest in that service or in that commodity, coupled with the capability to pay for it over some reasonable period of time.
Mr. Wilcox, what's brought about the change in the character of the banking business?
I think probably that the change has occurred in the marketplace rather more than it has in the banks. If you simply look at the financial requirement of birthing and growing and training and schooling children, to the requirement of housing, home improvements, such modern utensils as are required, the problems of marriage and after, there seems little doubt that the dimensions in service requirement are greater now than they were 25 years ago. And so I'd say that it isn't so much that we have necessarily initiated the change as much as it is that we've responded to the requirements and demands of the market that we serve.
Have you ever gone into the motivation of borrowing?
Perhaps a psychology major might answer differently, but I have a private theory that people nowadays look for and require more immediate rewards from labor. Our facilities make it possible, it's obvious, to enjoy the fruits of labor earlier than was the case 25 years ago. But rather than being harmful, I personally get the impression that the enjoyment of the new car or the boat, or the icebox, or whatever, is in itself an incentive to harder work.
Mr. Wilcox, how badly have you been burned on credit?
Very little, really. We have loaned almost $8 billion to 11 million borrowers since 1928, and our losses are at or about 0.25% of the amount loaned.
One of the reasons for the low rate of loss is, of course, that the banks lend money to good credit risks, and frankly, to those who don't really need it as a matter of sheer survival. There are many who do need it as such. But the have-nots, the minimum wage earners, the partially unemployed, those with the least job security, have no collateral to offer. So if the poor are able to get credit at all, it's the ironic rule that they have to pay more for it. In Newark, New Jersey, on the shopping street of a poor neighborhood, Alex Bethea, a labor union business agent and an anti-poverty program worker, tells CBS Reports producer Philip Scheffler what happens when a poor person needs furniture and doesn't have the money to pay for it.
He's denied if he goes to a reputable place, or the bigger stores, or a bank to borrow money. This forces him to come to the neighborhood where they advertise instant credit, $2 down, $1 a week. He's not in a position to argue with the man about price because he needs furniture, and this is a place he's going to be able to get it. The value of the furniture that he buys is about 50% of what he's paying. He's paying the highest interest rates, carrying charges, plus the penalties that for being late. All of this is higher than it would be if he went to the bank or at some reputable furniture company. After 6 or 7 months, the man finds that his furniture is beginning to fall apart, and he's in a dilemma. The credit that was extended to him, he still owes, but the furniture that is now falling apart. He can't go to the credit company and tell them the furniture is falling apart. They don't want to hear that, nor do the store want to hear it yet. Then he's forced to go back to the store and has to be reconsidered again renew his loan, and get more furniture on top of that.
There comes a time for some when even their minimal or grocery store credit runs out. Then the poor must go to their ultimate creditor, the loan shark. Loan sharking is no invisible empire of usury, but a big business estimated at $2 billion a year. And those in it often feel like benefactors.
People come to me because they've already been to the bank and they've been to their finance company. The next step is the loan shark. They need money right away.
What do they need the money for, do you know?
It could be a number of things. It could be for business. It could be for gambling. They just need money, that's all. You don't know what they need it for. Before I give the man any money, I'll be very careful. By being very careful, as he's been to me before, and I've had no trouble with him. And if I loan him $100, he would pay me $15 a week for 8 weeks. And that's how it goes.
How can you be sure you get the money back?
Well, you don't loan out as much as a finance company gets for a car or a bank. You don't go quite that high. But if you do have that problem, the only thing you have to do is just keep pestering the party, that's all. Pestering until he gets tired enough, he starts paying you back.
Do they try to pay you back because they think they need you? In other words, they need to keep you
that's
as a
one,
source?
That's one reason. That's right. That could be one reason that they always want to keep a door open whenever they need money, that they can get money right away without having to wait. I am the last resort after the finance company come the loan sharks.
The enormous mountain of credit continues to grow, but some economists now detect volcanic rumblings within it. As the credit-stoked economy continues to expand, fears are beginning to be expressed that this expansion may at some point, perhaps even now, slip out of hand. On the financial pages, sometimes the front pages, come increasing warnings of inflation. In Washington, economics now vies with politics for interest. Secretary of the Treasury Henry Fowler is cautious but concerned.
We are in a very unusual, a very critical period where, on top of this very healthy expansion, we do have the uncertainties that are created by the situation in Vietnam. Either that the war might expand in volume, or that it hopefully it might suddenly terminate with the movement to the peace table. So either of these contingencies would present a change in the situation for which we want to be ready in our thinking. This 59-month recession-free expansion that we are currently enjoying has given considerable hope to those who feel that the periods between recessions can be much longer, as well as the depth of the recession very moderate. But it is conceivable, of course, that if we had a recession which lasted for a substantial period of time or was a particularly sharp one, that the inability of, let's say, these families who were greatly overburdened by debt to meet their repayment schedules might add to the malaise of the period.
Dr. Charles Walker of the American Bankers Association.
We've got to be willing, as of now in 1966, to keep speculative excesses from developing, to keep the economy from overheating, to keep inflation away, because, in my judgment, it's this sort of situation which makes you move up too fast that makes you come back down again. I do not foresee, and I don't believe, that we would have a situation like the 1930s. I don't believe that we'd see unemployment rise as high as it did in 1960 or 61. But it could be troublesome. And this is all the more reason for keeping the present boom from getting out of hand, from following good fiscal and monetary policies, so we won't have to face a situation where our credit load could be burdensome if things slacked off.
There is restraint in these warnings, as there is restraint in the general approach to inflation, because there is no wish to alarm unnecessarily. But the belief is that even an understated word to the wise should be sufficient, as it would be coming from a doctor or a fire inspector, for overheating of the economy constitutes a definite hazard. And it's not only the nation's economy, but a family's economy that can overheat when it borrows too much and then can't pay back. We'll look at some personal situations in a moment after this message. Last year, 160,000 families declared personal bankruptcy in the United States. And that figure, like all the statistics on debt, is on the rise. And there are hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions more, whose paychecks have garnishments attached, whose television sets, furniture, cars, and appliances have been repossessed, who are being threatened by lawsuits. A new phrase has emerged in the economic lexicon, the overextended family. Through the efforts of several nonprofit debt counselors, we were able to locate three families who were willing to tell us of their financial misadventures. Their stories represent the three leading causes of overextension: impulse buying, family emergencies, and inattention to rising debts. The Gormans of Detroit earn $6,000 a year. They are the salesman's delight. For years, they bought and borrowed on impulse.
It was very easy to get a loan because I would go in and they asked for a reason for a loan. Well, I said, well, I want to go out on a town tonight. And he said, well, we can't put that down. We'll just put down to consolidate the bill. So went out that night and spent the money and wasn't thinking about paying it back at the time. But at the end of the month, all these places start coming due. And I didn't realize, crying out loud, there's three or four different outfits I hit up during the month, and they all come due at one time. It was pretty rough to pay back. But I don't know, I was getting myself into a rut, I guess, on these finance companies. I was borrowing from one finance company to pay off another. But I never had any trouble getting a loan.
I remember one Christmas, I went to the parish credit union and borrowed just as much as I could, $600-$800, something like that. And the way it was done, I'm not sure it was even legitimate, but I thought it was at the time. And then I went out to one of the big stores and charged just as high as I could charge. But from noon until Christmas Eve, when the stores closed, I had spent $1,800 on toys and movie cameras and typewriters, bicycles, and all that sort of thing.
I'd come home with my paycheck, and me and the wife would be sitting at the kitchen table figuring who to pay first, and they'd be knocking on the front door, you know, and he'd get the first payment, whoever would come up first. And then the rest of the week would go by, and my other creditors would be calling work.
The Schultzes of Madison Heights, Michigan, have an income of $7,000 a year. They borrowed up to the limit they could repay, and a series of emergencies threw them over the edge.
Well, I owed money to the house and the siding, and I owed some money at the union, credit union, and there's four or five other small bills, or five or six other small bills that had came in. My dad's funeral was one, and small things like that. We borrowed money from different loan companies, and sometimes we borrow this, and something would come up, and we needed a little bit more, so we were dissatisfied with the one company. Well, we went to the other one. I wasn't satisfied. Then also, I made a loan. Wife suggested we'd make it to him to help this friend of ours out. Well, I lost $100 there. I had to pay the loan. Well, that put me in the middle, see? Just little instances like that. And that hurts when you get them things like that. It builds up so that it's just too bad.
The Taylors of Downers Grove, Illinois, earn $10,000 a year. They just drifted in over their heads. They didn't pay attention to their rising debt load.
We owed the mortgage holder, loan companies, department stores, local independent stores, doctor bills, even in some cases the news agencies. It had gotten to a point where you were continually robbing Peter to pay Paul, and you never paid Paul back. Buying on credit is made easy, and was, so therefore we did. And eventually we found ourselves way in debt to a point where we could not pay back what we were borrowing.
We didn't always, I shouldn't say we didn't always have the cash. We did, but I think it was a lot easier just to say, well, I'll pay it next month, or pay a double payment next month, or sooner than not buy it, I would charge it. Just learning the hard way.
We had not gotten in the habit of saying no, though. And there were a lot of things that were foolish, and we never learned to say no, but we have since.
These three families are in the hands of professional debt counselors who, for a modest fee, stave off creditors, spread the available money around, and teach the families how to live within their income. We ask Price Patton of Chicago, who has been saving debtors from themselves for 25 years, what caused these family difficulties.
It's a competition. It's a competition to extend credit, and that coupled with the fact that the resistance of people, of course, is weakened by the fact that there are so many fascinating things to buy and to do. And all this put together, of course, has spelled quite a trap for people who are not very, very careful in planning ahead. We have to have a free flow of business and consumer credit, but it's, it's sort of like, say, the matter of something to drink. There's a bar, you know, in every block, and it's certainly easily available, and people have to exercise some sort of restraint.
President Johnson's Consumer Advisory Council is concerned about the Gormans, the Schilts, and the Taylors. This council meets periodically throughout the year and recommends legislation and policy to the president. We attended a recent meeting of the Consumer Advisory Council to get its views on the problems credit brings and the solutions.
Well, it certainly seems to me that the
greatest credit evil that we have at the present time is the misrepresentation, the widespread misrepresentation of interest rates. If it weren't for this, the consumer himself would be a better, be able to do a better job of policing the credit market.
There's no question about it. A lot of consumers, particularly younger people, I would imagine, being relatively inexperienced in purchasing big-ticket items where credit is common, I dare say that most of them simply haven't had much experience, and so it's very easy for them not to realize how much of the cost of a total installment contract is represented by the interest charges and the other charges that go with it being an installment purchase.
Remember, we have had no really serious recession even in 30 years, and these kids don't know what a recession or depression is. They think that everybody has always lived like this, and they start out with an aspiration level to achieve immediately something better than their parents have done in 30 or 40 years of married life. And the only way they can do it, really, or the only way they can come close to doing it, they can't do it, really, the only way they can come close to doing it is by using credit.
Actually, it's not just that consumers are inexperienced with big-ticket items, but also buying small-ticket items heavily on credit. Traditionally, we always paid cash for clothes and other low-price items, but now we're beginning to buy those very heavily on credit through revolving charge accounts, junior charge accounts, revolving budget accounts, and so on.
There's a necessity in this whole field for a broad-ranging, hard-hitting congressional investigation, I'm sure, because we really don't know who it is who owes the money. Are these almost entirely low-income families, or are they middle-income families? We know how much consumer saving there is, and we know how much consumer borrowing that there is, but we don't know whether the people who have the savings are the people who have borrowed the money. In fact, we suspect that they are not.
The question originally asked, I think, hit at a real point, which is that credit has now become something that sellers go after on its own, and that's the tail wagging the dog.
But this unregulated element or credit industry that has grown up continues to press for more and more because that's where they make their living.
In terms of the public policy on this question, I should think that the first move would be toward full disclosure. We were talking about interest rates being too high, and one can say high relative to what? And I would say high relative to what they would be if everyone knew what they were paying.
But let's not overlook the fact that the government does set many interest rates. The state sets interest rates in almost every state. In California, the maximum allowable for finance companies, which many states call small loan companies, is 30%. Now, the Corporations Commissioner, in the most recent year that he surveyed, found that 99% of the loans made by these companies to consumers were made at the maximum rate. By and large, these maxima set the going rate so that they don't have to have collusion, you say. And their competition can't operate because the consumer is ignorant and uninformed. I mean, they keep him that way.
A competitive market to operate requires knowledge on the part of the buyer. And the buyer thinks he's got knowledge. He pays 6%. Everybody pays 6%. Everybody knows that everybody, when they borrow money, pays 6%. And the answer to that is nobody ever pays 6%. They pay much more. And if you just had to tell them you're paying 12%, you're paying 18%, you're paying 24%, then they'd start looking for 6%, find they couldn't find it, and settle on 12%, which I think we'd agree is basically a pretty fair rate for the risk involved. But usually people don't shop for credit. I mean, it's inconceivable to the average person that you should shop for credit the way you'd shop for an automobile. And yet, you may find that in buying an automobile, you lose what you gain on the, quote, good deal, unquote, by getting a very poor credit arrangement through a dealer, for instance, who says bank rates, whatever that means.
I think we've in many cases gone overboard, as has been suggested here. And particularly the young family, we do tell them the rate of interest on their house payment. But all of the young families told that the revolving, when they, when the revolving charge account or something, is low down terms, easy payments, added to your revolve account, and they are not given enough information about the cost of this. If we want to do consumer education, let's do it at the point of purchase. Let's tell them the price of credit, too.
As it enters the sixth year of unbroken, unprecedented prosperity, this country is going through a gigantic credit explosion. The fallout could be hazardous. For though the economy has expanded and living standards have risen, private debt is increasing at a faster rate than personal income, personal savings, or gross national product. Bankruptcies are on the rise. Mortgage foreclosures have doubled in 5 years. The credit situation has become especially pertinent because as the Vietnam War begins to put one boom on top of another, the warning signals are up against inflation. Restraint is the new watchword. The new economics of deficit spending, of which consumer credit is a clear reflection, was created to overcome depression. But many economists dispute that it is necessarily valid for maintaining affluence. The present consensus seems to be that massive credit is useful and beneficial, but that the system has grave inadequacies, that interest rates are higher than they need be, that the people who need credit the most find it hardest to get on terms they can afford, that the patchwork of state and federal regulations tends to favor the lender over the borrower, that we would be on a sounder basis if people had a more accurate idea of the cost of credit. There is no sign that the house of credit cards will collapse. But it is recognized that if a recession comes, the vast debt will make recovery slower and more difficult. But behind the economic questions lies a moral one, which is widely evaded. Can too much credit, too easy access to material comfort, lead to a blurring of personal and national values? And shouldn't such values be part of the gross national product, too? While this program was on the air, the amount of private credit, that is debt, in this country increased by $2,500,000. This is Alexander Kendrick. Good night.